What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means?
Carpe diem. That's seize the day.
Very good, Mr.
Larson, sir.
Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No. Ding. Thanks for playing anyway.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Oh, Captain, my Captain. I love it when you sound eager to please, Josh. If Robin Williams ever failed to seize the day, it wasn't on camera. This week, we celebrate the life of the late comedian and actor with a Sacred Cow review of Dead Poets Society, plus our top five Robin Williams scenes. That and more.
Will those be on the final exam, Captain?
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including Joseph from Burke, Virginia, Omar from Chula Vista, California, and Owen from London.
We also have two new $5 a month subscribers, Anthony in Victoria, Minnesota, and Nigel. He's not Nigel Tufnell, but he is in Tufnell Park, London. A gold-level donor, James in Birchwood, Warrington, Cheshire, UK, and some Silver Club donors, Brian in Valparaiso, Indiana, Chris in Cambridge, UK, and a longtime supporter, George in Red Wing, Minnesota, who says, congratulations on your recent milestone. How many podcasts can claim 500 shows? I've enjoyed everything from the Sin City Rumble until today.
Thank you, George, and everyone who supports the show. Later in the podcast, we'll share a few more listener notes and dedications.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. And Josh, you certainly picked a hell of a show to return to following your vacation. It's good to have you back.
Well, it was a hell of a shock to get on vacation to hear about Williams. And, it's good to be back to consider his career together.
Well, 2014 probably will be remembered as the year we lost too many too soon in February. Philip Seymour Hoffman in March, Harold Ramis, and now Robin Williams. We say goodbye to beloved actors, of course, and directors every year, as we did just last week in the wake of Williams' death with the news of Lauren Bacall's passing. But the thing these three men have in common, I think it's notable, Josh, Hoffman, Ramis, Williams, is when we first encountered them and what kind of impression they made on us. That plus the fact that their careers were far from over. We mourn their deaths and we mourn work we'll never see.
Yeah, I think one of the things you can do for those of us who didn't know Williams personally is you take solace a little bit by revisiting the work, right, and exploring what it meant to you. And we do have, I think, more personal attachment because of the era that he largely worked within and are coming to really love movies during that time, too. So, yeah, that's what we're going to be doing for much of this show. Williams will, of course, be remembered as the manic genius, the side of him perhaps best captured on screen in Disney's Aladdin. But for sensitive future English majors, Williams turn, and me too, as John Keating in 1989's Dead Poets Society will always have a special place in our hearts. We've got a Sacred Cow review of the Peter Weir film later in the show. But first, Adam, let's get started with our top five Williams scenes with the results of the poll question that you and Michael Phillips asked last week. You simply ask listeners for their favorite Williams performance.
And we gave them these choices here that I think everyone would agree are pretty seminal Robin Williams performances, the ones everyone immediately goes to in their minds when you think of him. And the first choice was Aladdin, the genie, Dead Poets Society, John Keating, The Fisher King, where he played Perry, Good Morning Vietnam, Adrian Cronauer, of course, there, and Sean McGuire in Good Will Hunting. But if those five didn't work for you, you could go with other. Josh, how did it come out?
Adrian Cronauer was in last place with 10%. That was followed by Other with 13%, and then a couple here bunched up in the middle. Perry from The Fisher King, 15%, The Genie, Aladdin, 16%, and John Keating from Dead Poets Society with 17%, which means Sean McGuire of Good Will Hunting won with 28% of the vote.
It was the movie he was finally awarded an Academy Award for, won Best Supporting Actor for that performance. Aaron Teachman in D.C. writes, "The grown-up in me really truly loves The Fisher King. Robin Williams captured that heart of that character so well. Every part of Perry, the aching, broken hole at the core of his being, the commitment to the idea burning his psyche in the faint hope that his behavior might get him rescued. Williams was affecting, charming, insane, hilarious, frightened, and intense. But there's a little kid inside of me who can recite Aladdin from memory, and I would not have that film so deeply etched into me were it not for the sheer manic brilliance of Williams."
regular emailer Max O'Connell from Syracuse. He went with the other category. It's a close call between The Fisher King, which is the best use of his inherent desperation for love as an actor, and Popeye, a performance that brings me no end of joy. Both show him at his most boisterous and his sweetest. I think I might lean towards Popeye, though, because I can't think of another person who could capture everything about a cartoon character without disappearing themselves, nor could I think of many other actors who could make a live-action cartoon seem vulnerable and human.
Yeah, Popeye definitely got some votes in the other category, but glancing at them really quickly, not totally scientific here, but the top vote-getters when people write in their other option: World's Greatest Dad, the Bobcat Goldthwait movie, I think we're going to hear a little bit more about. One Hour Photo, Mrs. Doubtfire getting some love. The World According to Garp, which will definitely get some love later as well. And The Birdcage, also in the mix there in the top five other options. Jeff Gibson in Olympia, Washington says, "You know, when considering Williams' greatest performance, I was compelled to choose something that both captured his manic comedic timing and his talent for poignancy." I hope no one's out there drinking every time we say the word manic.
That would be a bad idea.
Because... yeah, you're going to be in trouble by the halfway point of this show. This leaned me toward Good Morning Vietnam. However, if I were to be honest with myself, I've only seen that film a couple times. My favorite performance that accomplishes the comedic and the dramatic perfectly, there it is, Mrs. Doubtfire. His hilarious antics and drag are probably what the film is best remembered for. However, I'm always touched, almost always moved to tears, by scenes that focus on how much this father is torn apart by his divorce and inability to be with his kids. The final monologue of Doubtfire reading a letter from a child stricken by divorce almost always adds dust to the room for me. So I vote other for this omission on the list. You know, Mrs. Doubtfire, a movie I remember seeing in my younger days in the theater, and I was taken with Robin Williams' performance. I don't know that I look back on it so fondly, but there is that one scene that I think is classic Williams, because it's how we think of him in that manic mode where he is talking to the woman, I think, about trying to get a job. Like, he's looking for a job and she's just taking his application down, and we only see Williams over her shoulder. So I don't know that we ever see her face during this bit where it's an extended series of jump cuts as it's just Williams riffing and going through all these different voices. And it's hilarious. And the whole time I'm watching it, all I'm thinking is, I would love to have a camera on her face, on the actress's face in those moments as she has to watch Robin Williams do what he does so well. And how could she possibly keep a straight face? I'm guessing she wasn't.
Well, maybe that's why they had to do the jump cuts, right? To,
yeah.
To give her some space. I have a coworker who names Mrs. Doubtfire as his favorite film of all time.
Come
you know,
on.
I'm not kidding you. Do you know anyone else who's ever given Mrs. Doubtfire that honor?
No. And I think he needs to listen to the show more often, or we need to give him some learning.
So you don't respect that choice?
No, I do not.
Amazing. John from Bloomington, one more note here. Had to go with Other and World's Greatest Dad. The pitch black but profound premise wouldn't have worked without Williams' sweaty hangdog charm, something he always had in his back pocket. A great performance in a very underrated movie.
Well, I agree with both of those sentiments, as I think you do as well, Josh. Let's get in now to our top five Robin Williams scenes. And as we do this, I can honestly say that there was a time in my life when, if you asked me who my favorite actor was, my first choice was Robin Williams.
Wow.
I really felt that strongly about him because of some of the performances, but the movies overall obviously just
was
had...
Was this the 80s run?
Well, it was the early 90s, really.
Okay.
And I look back, yes, I was terribly young and naive, but it would have been right about that time, actually, 1992, 93, the year I really got into movies, and that was around my senior year in high school. The Fisher King had just come out in 1991, Dead Again the same year. He's got a really small role, but I did love that movie in 91. Dead Poets Society was a few years before in 89. I probably didn't see it until 90 or 91. And then going all the way back to The World According to Garp in 82, it was his second film role after Popeye. That was a movie I always had a real soft spot for. So you add those all together around 92, because especially of Dead Poets and Garp and Fisher King, he just managed to capture for me something that I clearly wanted to see expressed on screen. He hit certain notes that I think we're going to touch on here as we get into our list that just really resonated with me.
Yeah, and I think the material for a while there was so strong too. Probably for me, it was starting with Dead Poets and then going into Fisher King, which I loved quite a bit when it came out. I don't know if I would have said he was my favorite actor at the time, but he was definitely in some of my favorite projects. And this has been, going back and looking at a lot of his stuff over the last week or so, has been a real corrective for me, because I sat through a lot of the bad stuff he found himself in.
And see, I didn't. I skipped that
towards
stuff.
Maybe, you know, the 2000s or the late 90s. And it had unfortunately kind of cemented in me this untrue opinion of his career in general and maybe even his talent. Mm-hmm. So it was really refreshing to sit down and kind of take in total at least what he had done mm-hmm. filmography-wise and actually watch a lot of the really good stuff again.
My guess is that happened for a lot of people who are listening to this show right now, maybe as they've gone back and revisited some of the work that they had soured on him over the years. I've seen the other sentiment expressed, though, where they assumed they liked him more than they did, meaning they looked at his filmography and they saw just how many bad titles were there and said, wait a second, why are we eulogizing this guy? Because he really wasn't doing great work.
It's not a batting average thing, right?
No, it's not. We've
talked about, especially Michael Phillips brings it up all the time, the difficulties that actors face in choosing projects. And I think it's more fair to look at what they did that worked so well, especially someone who is as busy as he was.
Well, as you mentioned, batting average, just to lay it out there, I went to IMDb. I really had no sense of how many credits he had. And, you know, this is always a little bit skewed because they're counting every appearance on screen ever, including little bits on TV and cameos here and there. But IMDb lists him as appearing in 104 roles. Going back to 1977 all the way up to 2015, a movie that's slated for release later called Absolutely Anything, where he does voice work as a dog. If you go to Letterboxd, a site we both frequent, and you type in Robin Williams, it comes up with 92 credits. And I was kind of shocked and horrified to learn that of those 92, I had only seen 23. 25% of his work. Now, of those however many, 60 I haven't seen, 70 I haven't seen. How many do I really regret? Only The Birdcage. It's a movie I would really like to see. I've heard really good things about his performance. And as a Shakespeare guy, never seeing Hamlet, the full Branagh version, I can't believe I even just admitted to that on air, frankly. So
I think we should just stop this show and go watch Hamlet.
No one probably looks at that turn as Osric and says that's definitive Robin Williams, but it is one I regret seeing. So we have set the table a little bit. Let's go ahead and jump into the list. Your number five, Robin Williams scene.
I'm going to start with something that I think was one of the most effective screen uses of Williams in that high energy mode that we associate with him. And it also actually earned him his first Oscar nod. This is from Good Morning Vietnam. It's Barry Levinson's 1988 Vietnam War comedy drama, I guess you would describe it as. Williams plays Adrian Cronauer, the irreverent DJ for U.S. Armed Services Radio. Now, with Williams, for me, looking back at a lot of his stuff, I realized it was often the delivery and not so much the content that really worked, that I really found funny. His material on its own isn't always that strong, at least
in my mind.
That's
a really good point.
And that's okay. I mean, comedians have different gifts, but it did surprise me to realize that. I will say, though, however, he has a lot of good bits in Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah.
He hits, and they use jump cuts, as you mentioned, quite frequently, which maybe is sort of a cheat when you're talking about a performance in his stand-up. He has to sustain that, right, without a jump cut. And in Good Morning Vietnam, there are a lot of jump cuts in his broadcasts. But there is one section where he riffs after the record that he meant to play starts at a slow RPM. That's full of good stuff.
The wrong speed. We've got it on the wrong speed. For those of you who are recovering from a hangover, that's going to sound just right.
Let's pull it right back down again. Let's try it a little faster, see if that picks it up a little bit. Let's get up on 718. Those pilots are going right now. I really like the music. I really like the music. I really like the music. Oh, still a bad song.
Hey, wait a minute. Let's try something.
Let's play this backwards and see if it gets any better.
This new vip, Freddy is a devil. This new vip, Freddy is a devil.
Picture a man going on a journey beyond sight and sound. He's left Crete. He's entered the demilitarized zone.
I really like this scene, the fact that you can see throughout Forrest Whitaker and Robert Wool just cracking up in the background. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to be doing it in character. So it's not like a blooper scene or something, but it works on those two levels. You know they're really laughing, too, because this little bit here is sustained. It is clear and on its own. And then there are jump cuts later.
Mm-hmm.
So I just love how it gives Williams' stream of consciousness this big screen on which to flow. And so Good Morning Vietnam, that's my number five.
Well, it's a fantastic choice. It's so good, it's my number five.
We either got our wires crossed
or this one just appropriately, perfectly needed to be in here. This is what I'm calling the Nowhere to Run sequence. That's the first song he plays. And it's the first big extended sequence where we see him on air. And unfortunately, we'll never get to see him accept any more awards or down the road. Perhaps maybe he'd be in line for a lifetime achievement type award. But if we did, isn't this the scene all those tribute videos start with?
Good
this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
That line, Good Morning Vietnam, when he hops on the mic the first time. And I should say, as I go through my list, I've got a mixture here, I think, of what I would call Robin Williams canon choices.
Okay.
Ones like this one that I just think are essential Robin Williams, and others that are more personal, though one of the canon picks, I think, is as personal as the other ones I'll mention. But here he is in this Nowhere to Run sequence doing what he did best, what maybe he did better than anybody on screen has ever done, riffing. High energy, stream of consciousness riffing that feels improvisatory, feels as though he's making it all up on the spot. And most times he was. In fact, he might have been in this sequence, but it's so precise and so funny and goes to so many interesting places that it almost feels like it had to be scripted. There's no other way to explain all the directions he goes in. Though I agree with you, if you really break down the material, half of it's probably really funny, the other half not so much,
right.
But 100% of it's funny just because of Williams' delivery.
And when you're working that fast, I mean, who cares if one joke dies a little flat?
Again,
he's got three more right afterwards.
Again, the batting average. It doesn't really matter when the hits are that good. And you don't get it in the online clip that I found on YouTube, but if you watch the movie, for me, it's all about the moment just before he goes live on air. Really calmly, serenely getting ready. There's nothing different about him than any other radio personality who's ever done this before. But when the switch is flipped and he goes live on air, that switch gets flipped in him. And that's a really rare talent, the way he can do it that fast. And I agree with you, too. I even had it in my notes. The wrong speed stuff is probably my favorite bit in that entire sequence. And I also noted the other actors, watching Forrest Whitaker and especially Robert Wool cracking up. It goes back to that Mrs. Doubtfire scene where I had to imagine that.
Yeah, you get to see him here, right?
Was really dying. Here they are dying for us to appreciate. I really do think that this is just Williams probably at the height of his charismatic powers anyway. So I'm with you on this scene from Good Morning Vietnam. It's my number five as well. What about your number four?
Not a canon pick, I don't think.
Okay.
Although it did get a few other votes in the poll that we put up about his best performances. Comes from World's Greatest Dad. Saw this just a few days ago, and believe it or not, this was my first Bobcat Goldthwait joint. I've been meaning to catch up with some of his stuff.
Really,
I know he has huge fans.
Really interesting filmmaker.
It was an interesting film, and as blackly comic as promised, especially given the circumstances of Williams' death here for this film. In it, he plays a high school English teacher. He's also an aspiring writer, and he has this horrible, rude, porn-obsessed teen son. Daryl Sabara plays him, and I mean, it's a really committed performance.
Oh, yeah.
He just wants you to despise this kid, and he makes it work. Well, this teen dies in an embarrassing accident. Let's just say it involved the porn. And what the father character decides to do is stage things so that they looked like a suicide. Then he lets his writerly tendencies get away from him a little bit with this suicide note that he makes up, a manifesto of sorts that becomes hugely popular, not only with the students in the school where he teaches, but really nationwide. So the scene I'm picking comes sort of toward the end of the film, definitely the second half, and it's when Williams is on a TV talk show being fawned over by this Oprah-like host, and the seams in the charade he's been running, they're starting to come apart a little bit. He's asked to describe Kyle, his son, and he starts with a clear lie. He was a sweet boy. And this just sends him into this quiet little giggle that he tries to mask as a cry. And then he veers in and out as the scene goes on between cry and giggle, cry and giggle. And it's a bizarre little bit of layered acting that's also very funny in this cringeworthy way.
But there was a lot brewing underneath.
Tragedy is, I didn't know until his death how sad he was or profound.
Then at the end, he gets his act together eventually and delivers this almost in robot speech pattern, this warning about depression that the talk show he's on requires. That's what they want him to say. And he kind of, you know, gets into character and ends up saying it. And that clip, of course, does have even more resonance now. And I have noticed that people have been sharing it quite a bit in the wake of his death. World's Greatest Dad, it is one messed up movie, but it has quite a few standout moments with Robin Williams, including this near confessional scene.
World's Greatest Dad, part of the inaugural class of Film Spotting Golden Brick nominees.
Aha.
Moon ended up winning the Duncan Jones film that year.
Good fit.
But in fact, World's Greatest Dad was one of our top six choices. I really do think that's a movie that needs to be seen more. And you're right, it's a really complicated performance, really interesting movie. And I strongly considered multiple scenes from that film, but ultimately just missed the cut. That scene probably would have been my choice, though. I'm with you exactly on that pick. My number four, I'm going with another monologue, really, and that's going to be a theme that runs through my choices here, though this time he's not just talking to the airwaves, even with other people in the room. He's got someone right next to him that he is directly speaking to, but it's a Robin Williams-driven scene completely, and it's the park bench scene I'm calling Presumptions of a Scared Kid. That's how it shows up in some places online, from Good Will Hunting. So his scene as Sean McGuire, the psychiatrist, to Matt Damon's Will Hunting. And up to this point, he hasn't been able to get through to him at all. He hasn't been able to connect in any meaningful way. And sitting on this bench, which I've seen a few things online over the past few days since Robin Williams died, a lot of people in the Boston area have been going to that bench. It's been kind of a sight that everyone can commiserate at. He's sitting there, and Sean really just incisively cuts to the core of who Will Hunting is, just guts him right open in a way that nobody has ever done it before. At the same time, he wholly reveals himself as well. And I did write an analysis of this sequence back in film school as a grad student, specifically about Gus Van Sant's use of the long take in the scene. And I really do think this is just a perfect marriage of form and content. It's about a 3-minute take, the camera focused on Robin Williams' face in close-up. And anyone who's curious about this sequence analysis, it's available at filmspotting.net. I'll link to it in the show notes if you do want to read it. But what I love is the way, as the scene goes on, you think the camera is just very slyly moving around. It's sort of rotating around Robin Williams. But actually what it's doing is it's including Will, Matt Damon's character, in the frame. So that by the end of the monologue, the shot is a two-shot with Will in the foreground and Sean in the background. And so it visually represents what's occurring before our eyes on screen, which is these two characters connecting, Sean taking this character, Will, into his world. And once he says this line to him, he says, "You don't know about real loss because that only occurs when you love something more than you love yourself." The film cuts to Will and the long take is broken. And it's perfect because the camera then holds on him for about 40 seconds and becomes another long take, though not quite as long. And it really does implicate Will in the scene. He says to him that this isn't just about me engaging you anymore. It's about me putting a challenge on you to be a different type of person. And that cut really accentuates that point. And the scene ends with him saying, "It's your move, Chief." And it makes perfect sense that it would end that way when you've really watched that whole scene progress. So I love that scene because of the way it's shot and edited, but it's also a great pairing, I think, with Good Morning Vietnam, our number five choices, because of the way it showcases those two poles of Williams' talent on screen. Mm-hmm. No shtick here, no jokes, no improvisation. There's no manic energy here. There's a respect for the words, a commitment to the character. There's the emotional truth of the scene. It's very subdued and really powerful.
If I ask you about women, you'll probably give me a syllabus of your personal favorites. You may have even been laid a few times. But you can't tell me what it feels like to wake up next to a woman and feel truly happy. You're a tough kid. I ask you about war, you probably throw Shakespeare at me, right? Once more into the breach, dear friends. But you've never been near one. You've never held your best friend's head in your lap and watch him gasp his last breath looking to you for help.
Do you think that was his quietest performance? It's been a while since I've seen it, so I'm not sure, but just bringing that scene to mind and others, it seems like that was the film where he really just quieted everything down. In a lot of his, there will be a moment or two where you get a burst, you know, and the best ones are where they try to stay in character too. But I don't remember many from Good
There's
Will Hunting.
There's not many in there, but I might argue the better choice for what you're describing might be 1 Hour Photo, which I just caught up with in preparation for this list. That's, I think, even more subdued. He really does take that manic energy out completely, and there's no joking in that character, at least not any intentional jokes on the part of that very lonely character.
Okay, Nwanda, ready to get into Dead Poets Society?
Let's do it.
Our Sacred Cow review of the 1989 Oscar winner is up next, plus the return of Massacre Theater. Stay with us.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, it's another delightful day here in vacation land.
Everybody, time to get up. Get up wherever you are.
That's right. Rise and shine, rise and shine. Got some songs going out right now to a couple of guys on the road to Nha Trang. You know what I'm talking about. Hey, Mr. O'Malley, O'Malley, you know, the Irish Dolby twins. They're out there. Special song going out to you right now.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I think to myself, what a wonderful.
Ooh, yeah. I was Louis B. Armstrong, the great Satchmo.
Happens this way. Maybe we really belong together, but after all little we know, maybe it's just for a day. Love is as changeable as the weather, and after all little we know.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. A couple hours before recording last week's show, we heard the tragic news of Robin Williams' death. The very next day, we learned of Lauren Bacall's passing. Bacall was 89. The news then, of course, wasn't such a stomach punch like it was with Robin Williams, but it seemed like more of an opportunity to reflect on her tremendous career and to celebrate a legend. She was only 19 when she made her screen debut in To Have and Have Not. You just heard a scene from that coming out of the break, her alluring performance of How Little We Know from that Howard Hawks movie. And our friend Dana Stevens posted a link to that video on Twitter last week. The audio can only convey so much, though. The real pleasure of that scene is the looks that we see Bacall and Bogey exchange during that song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what it's all about. We also wanted to read from Noel Murray's Bacall tribute, which appeared at the Dissolve. Bacall's legacy will be the run of performances she gave between 1944 and 1957, and in particular, the four movies she made with Humphrey Bogart. In To Have and Have Not, The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo, Bacall smoked, sang, seduced, and matched Bogart quip for quip and innuendo for innuendo. She looked up through her eyelids and compelled audiences to look right back. It was impossible not to.
You just put your lips together and blow, Josh, that great line. And I was thinking back on this as we're looking back as well at Robin Williams' career and movies like Dead Poets Society and when they had an impact on us. I think my first exposure to Lauren Bacall was probably a movie like 1996's The Mirror Has Two Faces. That's how I became aware of who Lauren Bacall was. And then you hear about how she's this legend. But I hadn't seen at that point movies like The Big Sleep or To Have and Have Not. Didn't see The Big Sleep for the first time until I was probably in college. And then you go back and see that movie and you see that moment when she first steps on screen and you go, okay, now I get it. Yeah. I get what all the fuss is about.
Exactly. Yeah, The Big Sleep was that one for me as well. Although to watch To Have and Have Not, it's astonishing. At 19, as you said, screen debut opposite Bogart, what confidence she had in that performance. And it's not only, you know, the look that Noel Murray talked about. It's interesting to watch her in that film, though, how often her chin is kind of pointed down so that she has to glance up and kind of be demure, but you know that's not what she's being. So it's definitely a cultivated affectation that she uses to great effect. But she just even has the confidence in exchanging the dialogue with Bogart. And she has the confidence. And here's the key thing, I think. Though she was a model, Hawks doesn't just want a model, right? He's interested in having actors and actresses who can do way more than that.
For sure.
Especially with the dialogue. So she matches that. But she also is able to show this character that she plays in To Have and Have Not, a con woman to a degree, she's able to reveal that the confidence is part of an act that that character has. She shows the chinks in her armor there that we can see she's had bad things happen to her without ever being unconfident as a performer. So she's even solid in showing that weakness. It's really a remarkable debut.
It is. And if you somehow haven't seen To Have and Have Not or The Big Sleep, can't recommend them more highly, especially for Lauren Bacall's performance. A quick housekeeping note here, Josh. Last week in our bonus content, which you can get if you have the Film Spotting app, Michael Phillips was here, and we did share some of his thoughts on the Richard Linklater movie Boyhood. Got his reaction to that movie and also shared some feedback on the top five films of the Film Spotting era, part of our 500th live episode. This week, we're going to get to the mailbag, listener reactions to Boyhood. And we're going to get a really strong case from a listener named Tyson for Linklater as his favorite filmmaker.
Okay.
And how he thinks Linklater should get more visual credit than he does. We also have an email from Josh Oakley relating Boyhood to our 500th episode that it's absolutely going in the file cabinet as one of my all-time favorite listener notes.
Wow.
If I'm ever doubting why I do this show every week, which I have to say I don't really have that thought, but if that time ever comes, I'll get emails like this out. It's that good.
Or maybe frame it.
Maybe frame it. You never know. So if you do want to hear that bonus content, all the information you need is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps. With that, we talk about Bacall. We're talking about Robin Williams. Great, great actors. Why don't we truly honor them, Josh, by doing some horrible acting of our own? It's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, which would have been our live recording of episode 500, we shared our top five films of the Film Spotting era. That's 2005 to 2014. And then via Skype, we had a chat with our pal, Ryan Johnson, the recently named writer-director of Star Wars 8. With a little help from listener Karen Miller, who drove all the way from Cincinnati for the show, actually, we massacred this scene.
I can't hold on any longer.
I am going to end this once and for all.
You can't. He must stand trial.
He has control of the Senate and the courts. He's too dangerous to be left alive.
I'm too weak. Oh, don't kill me, please.
It's not the Jedi way. He must live.
Please don't.
I need him.
Please don't. No.
What have I done?
That was Hayden Christensen as Anakin Skywalker, Samuel L. Jackson as Mace Windu, and the palpable screams of Ian McDiarmid as Supreme Chancellor Palpatine in that scene from Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith.
Somehow the Academy, maybe it's because they couldn't compare it to your performance, Josh, didn't recognize Ian McDiarmid with an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor like I pushed for way back on, I think, episode number 14 or 15 of this show.
You went
show.
That far
I went that
Revenge
far.
Of the Sith?
Yeah, I did.
Oh,
I went
that's
far.
That's excellent.
I went far. Edward Savoy from Harrisonburg, Virginia. He somehow manages to come up with, as many of our listeners do, Josh, a bunch of tie-ins we certainly didn't think of. But he says, I question if you can actually massacre a film that came to theaters already embalmed. But whatever you were doing, you did it to Star Wars Episode 3, The Revenge of the Sith. The connections are several-fold. We'll go through them quickly here. Sith was released in 2005, the same year that you began Film Spotting. And Will Collins and Donegal Ireland and others did point out, Josh, that it's a movie. As I suggested, I infamously went to bat for her. I said it was worthy of being in the same conversation as the original trilogy.
Hey, I'm with you there. You know that.
Yeah, I know, but you're
you
wrong.
Don't take
you
comfort
think,
in that.
You think one and two belong in that conversation
hey,
as well.
Don't be choosy when it comes to your fellow fans of the prequels. There aren't many of us, Adam.
That's true. That's true. Number two from Edward. You featured Rian Johnson on your show. Of course we did, and his tie-in with Star Wars. The film stars in your scene features Samuel L. Jackson, who also starred in Pulp Fiction, which was the audience choice for the movie that should be our next Sacred Cow at the live show.
Wait a minute. Wasn't that Reservoir Dogs?
Oh, you're right. It was Reservoir Dogs.
So only half a point for Edward there.
We're going to have to strike that one. You lose a point there. The film also stars Ewan McGregor, star of Trainspotting, the inspiration for the naming of your show. All of you showed love to P.T. Anderson films that, among other things, examine male power relationships, just as Palpatine exercises several forms of power,
the power,
unlimited and otherwise, on young Anakin. And finally, in a more existential sense, your 500th show is a prequel for what is to come in the future, just as Sith was. How's that for tie-ins.
Wow, impressive.
It is impressive. Thank you, Edward.
David Pate said, I also found some tie-ins to Adam's Top 5. Both Episode 3 and Inglourious Basterds are revenge stories. With The Master, There Will Be Blood, and Tree of Life, I'd say the link to the Star Wars saga would be daddy issues.
Fair enough.
Specifically, in There Will Be Blood, we see the dysfunction of a father who cares more about power than his own son. The most tenuous connection would have to be with No Country for Old Men. But as a child, the scariest possible villain for me was Darth Vader. And as an adult, it's Anton Chigurh.
There you go.
That makes sense.
I think David makes a compelling argument. Peter and Amy Valerio in Seoul, Korea also wrote in, I know you can imagine our surprise and pride when we were listening to your 500th episode. During the Massacre Theater segment, we were driving with the whole family in Seoul, Korea, where we live. Before the performance was half complete, our 11-year-old, a huge film spotting fan, we are huge with the preteen demographic, the 11-year-old shouted, Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. That was easy. Our 8-year-old said, yeah. That was easy.
Hey, sharp kids. What can we say? One last note here from John Newfrey. Give Karen from Cincinnati the Oscar for best performance. She nailed that movie with all the nailing it deserves.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
She was the best thing about that Massacre Theater for sure.
Well, if you want to hear that Massacre Theater and that entire episode, if you somehow haven't caught up with it already, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen at filmspotting.net. Josh, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Kyle Scherholz from Albany, Illinois. And Kyle, I believe, was at the live show.
He was. We appreciate that. And we congratulate you, Kyle, on your prize. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
What about me? What do? Do I just stand here like an object?
No. You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do fussy, fussy, fussy. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. Or Twyla, Twyla.
But you keep it all inside.
Sam busting out a brand new Massacre Theater theme just for the occasion here of paying tribute to Robin Williams. We do get to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we're not going to tell you any of the tie-ins. Hopefully, it'll become clear. It will reveal itself as we go through the motions here of our wonderful performances.
A clue early on, let's say that.
A clue early on.
The best
on.
Clue
yeah.
is probably early on. Unless yeah. your performance, I mean, if you no. do this right, no. Adam, it's going to be a dead giveaway.
There will be no right. Only wrong in Massacre Theater, at least with me, Josh. I'm going to start it off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
If you kill me, how are you going to get the bird? And if I know you can't afford to kill me, how are you going to scare me into giving it to you?
Well, sir, there are other means of persuasion besides killing and threatening to kill.
Yes, that's true. But there's none of them any good unless the threat of death is behind them. You see what I mean? If you start something, I'll make it a matter of your having to kill me or call it off.
That's an attitude, sir, that calls for the most delicate judgment on both sides. Because as you know, sir, in the heat of action, men are likely to forget where their best interests lie and let their emotions carry them away.
Then the trick from my angle is to make my play strong enough to tie you up, but not make you mad enough to bump me off against your better judgment.
By gad, sir, you are a character.
And scene.
You were right.
I told you only wrong.
No help there at
no,
all.
No, but I think you did. You did help give it away, Josh. Thank you for doing that. I think our listeners probably needed something beyond just the dialogue to ground that scene, and you did that. If you know what scene we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, September 1st.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I'm not just about funny voices, Josh, okay?
Oh, what was that then? What were you giving us if it wasn't a funny voice?
You mean it was a bunch of guys sitting around reading poetry?
No, Mr. Overstreet, it wasn't just guys. We weren't a Greek organization. We were romantics. We didn't just read poetry. We let it drip from our tongues like honey. Spirits soared, women swooned, and gods were created, gentlemen. Not a bad way to spend an evening, eh?
When we recently did our top five films of 1989, Adam, in conjunction with our Sacred Cow review of Tim Burton's Batman, Dead Poets Society wasn't on my list. In fact, when I named my top 10 from that year on Letterboxd, it wasn't there either. Oh no, you may have thought when we decided to do this Sacred Cow review of Dead Poets Society to honor the career of Robin Williams, was this going to be another To Kill a Mockingbird situation? To be honest, I didn't name Dead Poets Society as one of the top 10 films of 1989 because I didn't trust my 15-year-old impression of it. If any movie seemed tailor-made for a kid whose life at that time consisted mainly of devouring books and movies, as well as chasing after the girl he would eventually marry, it was Peter Weir's Best Picture nominee, about an unconventional poetry teacher played by Williams at a prestigious New England boarding school who inspires his students to follow Thoreau's advice and suck out all the marrow of life. So last weekend I watched, with trepidation, Dead Poets Society for the first time in a very long time. And you know what? It's hokey. It's cheesy. It's unabashedly inspirational. And I still loved it. I'll try to offer some respectable film critic reasons in a bit. But first, Adam, I want to get your experience with Dead Poets Society. What did it mean to you in 1989 or thereabouts? And perhaps more importantly, what's your explanation for the fact that you didn't list it as one of your top five films of 1989 either?
Well, I didn't list it in the top five, but I did list it in my 6 through 10.
Did it make
it? So it did make my 6 through 10, yeah.
All right.
And actually, in the course of that discussion, at the end of the top five, I listed my top five films of 1989 if I was making the list in 1989, and Dead Poets Society was number two. So a lot of love for the movie, but you're dead on in how you expressed your sense of doubt about the movie, not trusting your reaction. The reason it was as high as it was, but also not higher, was the same reason. It was because I didn't trust my recollection of the film, recalling it through the lens of nostalgia. Haven't seen it up until last night, just like you. I hadn't seen it since 1989 or maybe 1990 when I finally caught up with it, I think on VHS, I'm guessing, at the time, not DVD. It had to be in contention for my list because I had such a strong feeling about the movie from my past, but didn't feel like I remembered it well enough. Was that nostalgic haze so strong that I was giving the movie too much credit? Having now rewatched it, I have to say it very likely would have been my number five if I could go back and redo that list, or at least it would have been a much more difficult omission for
me.
It was kind of easy for me to slide it into that six through 10 because of the whole nostalgia factor. But my sense is of this film, and I could be completely wrong, but actually you supported it in your setup. There's this notion, I think, that as a cinephile, we're supposed to be a little bit ashamed of loving this movie. It's too earnest or sentimental, or as you just put it, it's too hokey or cheesy, or maybe it's just caught up in the fact, to quote my own bit of poetry here, Josh, when I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. We distance ourselves, perhaps, from such material because now we think we're too grown up and mature to be swayed by so much earnestness and emotion. I'm going to be honest with you, I don't get it. I don't think of Dead Poets Society as hokey. I don't think of it as cheesy. I think of it as serious and dramatic and emotional and inspirational. And there are things to be critical of with the movie, which I'm sure we'll get to. But whatever that is, whatever that hokiness as you see it and others may see it, that's not something I have any problem getting swept up in, whether it's 1989 or it's 2014.
And I think that's the honest way to look at it. Nostalgia is only a problem if it makes you deny something that you know in your heart is truly not working for you anymore, but you say, I'm going to love it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like this movie's really bad, but because I loved it then, I'm still going to love it now. And it sounds like that wasn't your experience with Dead Poets Society. I overall thought it held up maybe not as well as my experience was then, but very well enough. I think it's a very good film, quite strong. The hokiness that I'm referring to, you know, there are just scenes. Any construction of a scene where students are going to be standing up in their desk in solidarity has a level of hokiness to me. The scenes of them gathering around Williams as he's teaching them and they're in this sort of huddle up, boys, something like that, for me just has that little tinge to it. And a lot of the performance we'll get to, and I think it's a great performance, but a lot of his dialogue, these are life lessons where if you just read it on a page, I would be a little bit like, oh, really? But it does work for the film. And for me, if there's any resistance, it's only that, and this is my problem more than the movies, I recoil a little bit to any film that I can tell how it's wanting me to feel. So in other words, my favorite inspirational movies are the ones that inspire me when they're not trying to. And I think you could probably apply this to me to just about any film that's trying to make you feel something. I
you
like
mean
the ones
every
where
Hollywood movie
it's,
though.
It's well, no, not quite, because you'll get Hollywood movies where you'll find these little curly cues of idiosyncrasy on the side that for some reason resonates with me, and it may not be the exact moment where they wanted you to. Then you'll get the Hollywood films where you see the beats, and I think you do see the beats here, and maybe that's what I'm talking about. Is I just have a little less appreciation when you do see the beats now. The beats, for the most part, are really well handled in Dead Poets Society. And those are the reasons I think that we can defend a little bit more from those who would say, oh, come on, this is not a grown-up film.
Yeah, you definitely make a compelling argument, Josh, but that isn't the experience I have with this movie, or I guess maybe other movies like it. Yes, I too am awed by the small moments in movies, those idiosyncratic moments in movies. And I think there are some of them in this film that I respond to. But I also don't have a problem with seeing the beats. I think that's one of the real pleasures of going to the cinema, is seeing those grand, dramatic moments played out on a big screen and feeling things that you only feel when you watch a movie. I think there are some of those moments in this film, and they work because Peter Weir means it, and Robin Williams means it.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
This is not to say that I'm denying they didn't work on me.
Yeah.
I mean, the standing on the desks at the end works.
It does.
It does. So it has that going for it.
Well, I mentioned, I think, during our tribute to Roger Ebert when he passed away, I think I brought up Dead Poets Society because it was a moment for me when I realized that he is a critic and he was someone I really looked up to and really trusted, that I realized he was fallible, you know, at least in my eyes, because I love the movie so much. And I remember getting the 1991 Roger Ebert Video Companion, still have it on my bookshelf, and going to Dead Poets Society to have him confirm everything I think about this movie, and find that he gave it 2.5 stars.
Oof.
And if you look at his major issue with the movie, there's some fundamental truth to it, without a doubt. While at the same time, I do think he maybe completely misses the forest for the trees. And I want to talk about it a little bit because he has a great paragraph here where he sums it up. He says, "None of these writers are studied, however, in a spirit that would lend respect to their language. They're simply plundered for slogans to exhort the students toward more personal freedom. At the end of a great teacher's course in poetry, the students would love poetry. At the end of this teacher's semester, all they really love is the teacher." I think they do love their teacher more than the poetry. And this time, Josh, I really did feel that there were too many scenes of exercises in nonconformity and not enough poetry. I think after the second or third, you know, scene of them kicking a ball or walking a certain way or standing on the desk, that had all become crystal clear. And what I really wanted, even as I recognize that in the script, John Keating, the Robin Williams character, always brings it back to language. He does always punctuate any point he's making with the words of a poem themselves. But maybe it's just the English major in me. I do wish the screenwriter, Tom Schulman, and I wish Peter Weir as the director, had maybe trusted the poetry a little bit more to be the catalyst for their reinvention of themselves, their discovery of their identity, their sense of rebellion with where they currently are in life and with this school. I think it could have had more of a focus on that. I think Ebert does make a very valid point there.
Well, this thread of criticism was actually picked up this year in a piece that was noting the film's, what would it be, 25th anniversary, in The Atlantic. I think it was February. I'm forgetting the name of the writer, but he was an English professor and really a diatribe against Dead Poets Society. And this was essentially his argument as well. He called it anti-intellectual, actually, and that it was disrespectful to the poetry by misinterpreting it, that it was, quite frankly, I found it very alarmist. It spun off into this, you know, the humanities are being disrespected in general, and one of the main culprits is Dead Poets Society.
Okay.
So I'm not saying I'm buying the argument overall, but it does make some good points about how the texts themselves are treated in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that criticisms like that, Ebert's and this Atlantic piece, are missing one crucial thing, in that this is a high school classroom.
Right.
And, you know, not to say that teenagers cannot be challenged to really dig into text,
mm-hmm.
but you have to consider the starting point of the characters in this film.
You do.
These are kids who are being groomed for careers as doctors, lawyers, bankers. They sign up for this English course as something they got to get through, essentially.
Yep.
And so what this movie is doing, and what thrilled me so much when I was a kid, because I was about the same age, is it made knowledge, and the knowledge of literature particularly, something exciting, worth doing.
Right.
It gave it value. So we're starting at ground zero here. Now, you don't want to mislead kids at that point. So there's some, you know, rightful criticism in that if the Williams character is characterizing the poems incorrectly, you don't want to mislead kids. But I think this movie is at a baser level on a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's doing good. I mean, the movie is just getting these kids and the kids in theaters excited about literature, and I don't see a fault in that.
No, I agree with you 100%. I also would argue that you have to look at the movie as a whole and recognize that it's not fundamentally about poetry. It's a movie about identity. It is a movie about these people discovering who they are, what they stand for, and thinking for themselves. And there is something, to your point specifically, Josh, fundamentally essential about first falling in love with the concept of poetry. I think that's okay. The idea that it's a good thing and necessary maybe to be able to romanticize the romance in anything.
It's
and poetry
start somewhere.
Is one of those things. It does have to start somewhere. Poetry in this film is just a gateway to so many other things, ultimately a gateway to a more fulfilled life. And that scene early in the movie where he sits down with them at the end of the understanding poetry scene where he says, "What will your verse be?" He is challenging them. He's saying to them to find your voice. And I think the other thing that argument that Ebert and others obviously have made is that it does overlook the fact that Todd, the Ethan Hawke character, is clearly not only excited about what he hears in class, but seems to be genuinely taken with the language. Neil, the Robert Sean Leonard character, makes a decision inspired by the class to recite poetry for his vocation. He wants to be an actor, and we see him get to go on the stage mm-hmm. and be in A Midsummer Night's Dream. To a lesser extent, the character Knox, played by Josh Charles, what does he do? He becomes, in a way, a writer. You know, he expresses himself on paper to the woman he loves. And just the fact that he expresses himself is all he needs to do. He finally is able to say what he needs to say, whether she ends up falling in love with him or not.
At some point, she becomes secondary to the whole exercise, right?
Right.
It's more about the...
Is he going to have the guts to say what he actually has to say? And that runs through the entire film. So what you said about all this being a good thing, that maybe it's on a baser level, but at least it's just getting them excited. I would add on to that, what would you rather have? Characters who become better readers of poetry or who become better people because of the poetry? Ideally, they become both. That's what you would really hope for. But if you have to choose, I'll take the better people. And I think that that's what the movie is ultimately going after. And that's why I think, just like you, I responded to it as strongly as I did when I saw it in high school. It got me excited. Hey, I was one of those kids who, after I saw this movie, I went out and memorized the first stanza of Byron's She Walks in Beauty. I think probably just because I wanted to use it to woo a girl, just like Charlie Dalton does.
Were you more successful?
Movie.
Do you remember?
No, of course not. Of course not. I don't have any of the charisma that that character has who does end up branding himself Nuanda. But the movie really, more than anything, is about expression, and it's about identity, and poetry is just a part of that. It's not ultimately a film about how we should all really have these deep conversations about poems.
So you listed a number of the actors playing the students here, and I want to get to some of these performances before we get to the main one, which is Williams. Robert Sean Leonard, I think, is just remarkable in what I guess is sort of the lead student role, although this is a very deftly handled mm-hmm. ensemble piece in the way it does give us a piece of almost every character's inner life. But I think the way he's wearing this mask of accomplishment as this kid browbeaten by his father, who's sort of climbing a social ladder. They're not a wealthy family, so all his hopes are in this son to become a successful doctor, I think it is.
Yeah.
And Robert Sean Leonard's Neil is also kind of the ringleader of this group mm-hmm. that we come to know. And just the way he shifts, depending on who he's talking to, from subservient with his father to rounding up the troops and getting them excited and reviving this Dead Poet Society club, is really good. And then there's the tragic turn that the movie takes when there are repercussions for pursuing this acting career. I remember being so taken by his performance and thinking, man, we're just going to see this guy forever. And I know he's still acting and still working, but the performance still just held up incredibly well watching it again.
Father, I thought you'd gone.
Mr. Sir. Keep your seats, fellas. Keep your seats. Neil, I've just spoken to Mr. Nolan. I think that you're taking too many extracurricular activities this semester, and I've decided that you should drop school annual.
But I'm the assistant editor this year.
I'm sorry, Neil.
But, Father, I can't. It wouldn't be fair.
Fellas, would you excuse us for a moment? Don't you ever dispute me in public, you understand?
Father, I wasn't disputing
you. After you finish medical school and you're on your own, then you can do as you damn well please. But until then, you do as I tell you. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, I'm sorry.
You know how much this means to your mother, don't you?
Yes, sir. You know me, you're always taking on too much.
Well, let's move on. Allison, you need anything, you let us know. Huh?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think everybody's good here across the board. And it was good for me, too, because I had just recently watched Robert Sean Leonard in Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays Claudio, who, having seen three versions of Much Ado About Nothing recently on the stage and on screen, I've decided that I really just hate that character. And I think it's a really tough one to play to make that character interesting. But Robert Sean Leonard doesn't do it for me in Much Ado About Nothing at all. So I kind of hated him in that performance. And then to go back and watch Dead Poets Society, which was earlier, 4 years earlier, and see that, no, he's someone who is really strong and who is our gateway to Mr. Keating and to this world. He's the guy that we sort of follow. I think you have Ethan Hawke's character, who I think Ethan Hawke's very good as well. And I do love the irony of the guy who I dubbed on Letterboxd the Great Pontificator.
Yes,
he's the guy in this movie who... who can't talk, who has no voice, right? He literally has to find his voice in this movie.
And now with Linklater, he never stops talking. And a lot of his lines sound like he's reciting bad poetry he's writing in his head.
Right.
And I mean that, you know, not derisively, but that's kind of who he's become.
Right, but he's so distant and aloof and clearly has a lot of issues that he's dealing with. And Robert Sean Leonard is much more of an open book. And so he's someone that we can really relate to, and he's our guide through this movie. And that's why you're right. At the end, when the movie takes a tragic turn, it hit me harder in 1989 than it does now. And the reason is, I think, tied to one of my issues with the movie overall, which is I just didn't really believe it this time at the end of the movie. I didn't believe the tragic turn it took. I didn't believe that after watching this character blossom the way he blossoms and find his voice and find who he thinks he is and actually get a chance, even though you could argue in the scene with his father, played by Kurtwood Smith, that his father says, tell me how you feel, and you can argue that he doesn't really mean it, that he's going to shoot down whatever he says. And I do believe that. The fact is, he has a moment to finally say it. He could finally do it, and he chooses not to. He's too afraid to. And after watching this whole journey with this character and seeing him on stage, which it's thrilling to watch him on stage. Mm-hmm. He's good in the performance within the performance, too, as Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream. After going through all that, for me to believe that he is so afraid of his father and so afraid of saying how he really feels that in that moment, the defining moment of his life that Mr. Keating has actually been preparing him for, that he can't even take the chance. That's supposed to be the tragedy, I think. I didn't completely believe it. Am I crazy?
Well, I'll say this. I think that it's set up to be believable and that it's true that he might take that act because there's a thread that I seemed to notice this time that was not there for me, probably because I wasn't even thinking about this when I was younger, of there may have been sexual identity he was wrestling with at the same time.
Hmm.
And the reason it stood out to me this time around is because I noticed how rich the scenes were, and there are at least two of them, maybe even three, just between him and the Ethan Hawke character. He kind of, they're roommates, he takes him under his wing, so there's that level, and he's just generally caring guy. But the scene with the desktop set, especially to me, had a little different tone in it this time, where it seemed like their relationship, at least for the Robert Sean Leonard character, was really deepening.
Yeah.
And I did wonder if it's not something I think maybe even the film didn't intend, or maybe it is a subtext that they wanted to be there. But as the film went on, I wonder if that was one of the things that was adding to the burden he was carrying beyond his father's pressures. Now, the sequence itself that we're kind of talking around, but it's the main tragic event in the film, I think is incredibly clumsily handled. And that's the problem I had with it. There's use of slow motion. Weir uses a few odd camera angles, I think, at one point. The performances in general get a little off kilter there by Kurtwood Smith in particular.
Hmm.
And that whole, it's very extended as well. It's almost just the amount of time it's given. It deserves the time because it's a significant act.
Right. That's why it worked for me.
But the handling, the execution of it. So basically, we're on opposite ends of this.
Yeah.
I didn't believe how, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. One moment I really did like in that ending sequence with the Robert Sean Leonard character is we had just come away from watching him on stage where he closes out the production by saying, if we shadows have offended, think but this and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear. And that little bit of phrasing there ties into so many larger themes actually in the entire film, but that notion of shadows, and we actually do see him before we ever see Robert Sean Leonard. I think in that scene, we actually watch him go through some motions a little bit of a ritual, and we see him in the shadows. We mm-hmm. see him only in shadow, mm-hmm. and I don't think that was completely by accident.
And he's
I
speaking
like
to his father
touch.
There, who's in the back in shadows
yeah.
in the back of the
yeah,
theater.
Yeah, that's a good point. I did like that visual touch, and I do like some of the other visual touches. I don't think people think about this film in terms of it being very striking, and it's not overall, but Peter Weir's a really strong filmmaker. I mean, this is a guy who's made some very good films. Picnic at Hanging Rock. He's made The Truman Show, Master and Commander, I'm a big fan of. And one of the things I noticed this time with the film that I hadn't noticed before is the way he uses, it's become a really common technique now, but the 360-degree shots. That's something we see repeated at least four times, I think, in the movie. And they're all at key times that make sense for you to see him. The first one is in the classroom when they've all thrown away mm-hmm. J. Evans Pritchard, PhD, they've thrown away that introduction, and he's passing the garbage can around. And the camera yeah. starts on Robin Williams with the garbage can, and then as he passes it around, the camera does a full circle and comes back to him. And it just emphasizes sort of the breathlessness, the passion of this moment as they're all taking their first step to throwing out this old way of thinking.
Well, the rigidity of the classroom.
The rigidity of the classroom, exactly. And we do get it as well in the scene with Todd and Neil in the room where Todd is trying to write down his poem.
Oh, yeah.
And he wants to read it. Neil wants to see it, and he won't share it with him. And he grabs the notebook, and the camera follows them at 360-degree motion around the room. We see it two other times when they're in the cave, and we see it in the key scene in the classroom where Todd finally finds his voice. It's the sweaty tooth madman
yep.
bit inspired by the Walt Whitman picture on the wall that the character that Robin Williams plays really draws out of him. That too, in that moment, we get that 360-degree bit with the camera. All of those moments are these key bits where these characters are expressing themselves, or they're doing something wondrous and something joyful, and it is this breakaway from the rigidity of their classroom setting, of this entire life that they live here at the school they call Helton.
Well, there's even a variation on that early on when the camera is looking up at the main staircase yeah. and they're all tumbling down to their classroom and it
right.
starts spinning around. And yeah, it's just, I mean, the movie in part is a retort to educational stuffiness. And so how do you communicate that by bringing this fluidity that does kind of break
things
down?
I love the bird shot too, though, because it's actually a bit of a sly match cut. Right before it, we get three different shots, I think, of birds swarming around in the sky in circles. And it cuts
yeah,
right from that
yeah.
to the kids going down the staircase, looking a lot like those birds. They're all amped up. They're trying to get downstairs to breakfast or whatever they're doing. And they feel a lot like those birds in that scene. So there's some sly visual stuff going on in Dead Poets Society.
So should we get to Williams?
Sure.
I mean, I think it's one of the roles, I think, like Good Morning Vietnam, that most naturally allows him to have a little bit of that riffing persona from his early days, but in context of the character. I thought it worked. I mean, maybe you think it breaks apart or breaks him out of the John Keating character when he does a random impression,
no.
which isn't often. I thought it worked really well.
Yeah.
He chose his spots really well in this film and in this story to do it. It was almost the comparison I'd make is usually you think of him as a machine gunner just spraying jokes all over the place. And here it's more of a sniper attack where he's gonna drop one in here or there, hit their mark, and then he's gonna go back into the more teacherly, professorial aspect of the character. So
mm-hmm.
I like that about it. And what I also really liked is how it's a generous performance. Again,
yeah.
this isn't an ensemble piece. And I don't think this is something that probably came naturally to Williams just because of how he worked and his manner of comedy required constant attention on him, not because he was necessarily greedy for it, but because you had to keep up with him. And there's something about him taking a breath and opening up and allowing the space in the classroom scenes for these other actors to act with him.
Yeah, I think everything you said is bang on, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit more as we get through our top five here. I do want to touch on just a couple other nice little flourishes I liked in the movie. Earlier in the film, he does compel them to stand up on their desks
mm-hmm.
to view the world from a different perspective. And he says the world looks a little bit different from up here. And I did like the fact, again, something my eye wasn't really looking for in 1989 or 1990, but at the end of the film, in his moment of disgrace, when we don't see him how the school sees him, how the parents see him. But certainly that is who he is in that moment and who he's probably going to be the rest of his life. This is going to follow him. It's going to be very hard to shake off. And at the end of the film, in that moment, the "Oh Captain, My Captain" sequence, which is still thrilling to me to watch, when they stand up, when we first see Robin Williams really take that moment in, it's an overhead shot looking down on him from that perspective. And in that moment, it does reflect that idea that it's not so much about point of view, but it's about the audience's point of view, looking at him and recognizing that we do see him differently from up there. We now see him differently, even if it fits with the way we've seen him throughout this whole movie. He isn't the character that he's being painted to be. I also love just the little bit where, and I wonder how meticulous they were about this, whether or not this was random, it just worked out this way. Who knows? Robin Williams might have been riffing. But at the beginning of the film, they really emphasize the four tenets that they live by, the school, tradition.
Tradition's and number one.
Yeah, tradition, and then it ends with excellence. And the students have a different version of those four tenets, and excellence is replaced by excrement. And then, of course, what does he say after they read J. Evans Pritchard, Ph.D.?
Right.
He says, excrement. And that just sort of nicely sets up at the end of the film when it's now the headmaster coming to teach this class and asking them to get out the J. Evans Pritchard. Of course he's going to ask them to do that in a very, again, kind of comical, sly way. That's what the school is based on. The school really is much more about excrement than it is about excellence. And that's played out in that sequence where he goes back to that very thing that Robin Williams has told them is garbage. And I love little moments like that in this movie.
Well, and the fact that they have that variation of those four principles that the boys do themselves gets back to what we were talking about, who the characters in this story are. If they were in college taking classes in literature a bit more seriously, they wouldn't be doing that. That's kid stuff, right? So I think that that shows you how they're young and silly yet and just ripe for beginning to learn the value of literature.
Well, I look forward, as always, to getting feedback from our listeners on this movie. Maybe they go back to the fact that this is just nostalgia garbage and we're being too kind to it. But I wonder if listeners have any thoughts on the point you brought up about maybe this extra burden the Neil character is carrying that might be related to his sexual identity. That didn't occur to me as I watched the movie, but one thing that did occur to me or did show itself to me that didn't really back when I saw it originally, whether it's he's a homosexual or he's dealing with some of these thoughts, there is this real notion of masculinity that is carried through this movie. And Kurtwood Smith's character, the father, saying to him at one point, like, my son isn't going to be an actor.
There's this idea
that it's not just a lower profession. I always thought back on this movie as it being an issue of the son not doing something that was prestigious enough, that it would seem like he's throwing his life away because he does have visions of him being a doctor or something better than being an actor. But no, it's also that my son isn't going to do something as wussy as be an actor or deal with the school annual and those kind of things. You know, it's really more tied to that, or that's certainly a part of it. And that's something that I didn't really think about the first time.
Well, and someone makes a comment early on, one of the other parents to one of the kids about, oh, you're going to be, I don't know what it is, a banker or a lawyer, just like your father, huh? And the way the scene plays it is as a curse, right? For this kid is that his life is set in this preordained, manly position that he's going to be trained for, and the rest of the movie proceeds to kind of break that up.
Dead Poets Society, of course, available on DVD if you need to catch up with it or see it for the first time. We do want to know your thoughts. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
If I can get Adam to stop standing on the studio desk in solidarity, we'll finish our picks for the top five Robin Williams scenes next. Stay with us.
Everyone, I'd like to do very. This is Elmer Fudd. Sings Bruce Springsteen.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio. I pull you a little closer. You say no. You say you don't like it. I say you're a wire. But when we kiss, it's like fireworks.
Good night, everybody. God bless you all.
Well, as promised, we do want to jump in here real quick to share a few listener notes and some dedications as we do during our donation section. We start with a platinum level donation, Josh, from Scott Menser in Western Kansas, who congratulates us on 500 episodes. And for at least the second time, Scott donated, obviously it's a platinum level donation, a very sizable amount of cash. And just like the last time he donated a few years ago, I think it was, he did have a little request for some of his money.
Okay.
And I'm going to be honest, I haven't followed through yet. And I feel guilty about it, which is he wants us to donate a portion of the funds he sent our way to a film school student, someone who might need some money to finish a film project. And I love this idea, and I really do want to follow through. I just don't really know where to start, because I know we probably have right now about 1,000 people listening who could use that cash.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, are probably going to email us, but I want to do it through some kind of actual channel. We have a bunch of great film schools right here in Chicago that we'll probably take advantage of. But Scott, I'm going to follow through. Please do send me an email, though, so I can chat with you a little bit. We don't have any email. He likes to send handwritten notes in our mailbox. So.
For now, invest his money in a fund so that it builds until you're ready to get this thing going.
We'll collect 1% each year.
There you go.
And it'll be huge. Someone can make their next brick. So again, Scott, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and thank you for the donation. We did mention earlier, and we've mentioned before, Nigel Smith, Tufnell Park, London, a $5 a month
subscriber. I still don't believe there's a place called Tufnell Park.
And his name's Nigel.
Exactly.
I mean, really, it is spelled, I think, with two L's, and I don't think Nigel Tufnell is, but he sent us this nice note.
My last Buck a Show donation has well and truly lapsed, so I've finally done the sensible thing and committed to a $5 a month donation. Feel free to plug Tufnell Park Film Club on air again. Film Spotting listeners have joined us after the Squarespace-related mention. Take a look at all the movies we've shown, and I'm sure you'll agree that we definitely show stuff that will appeal to Film Spotting Nation. And we'll link to the film club in the show notes.
Yes, we will indeed. Thank you very much for that. Hopefully some of the listeners in the London area can add to that bunch of Cineas and have fun at the Tufnell Park Film Club. A Silver Club donation comes from Mark Kearney, Essex Junction, Vermont. Another case where a guy who actually does some work for us on the show for nothing essentially pays us to do the work for us.
I like
how
that works.
He does help us with our Facebook page and a few other things. And Mark just wanted to congratulate us on our 500th show. He says, you were my entry into the podcast medium and still my favorite, and I love recruiting listeners to Film Spotting. Can't wait to see you at number 1,000. Which I'm assuming will be broadcast from the moon or at least a space station orbiting the Earth.
Only if you're there to sell t-shirts, Mark.
Yes, Mark, we do need your help again. Let's put it in the books already. Man, I don't want to sidetrack this whole segment here, but thinking about 500 episodes, they feel like they have flown by, even though it's been over 9 years and it clearly hasn't. That's how it feels to me. But the thought of 500 more seems impossible.
Where does that put us at? Like, how many years would
it's going to be the same pace? Yeah, it's going to be another 9 to 10 years.
You can't pull that off?
I don't know.
You're looking tired, frail. Just talking about that.
That's how I feel, Josh. That's how I feel. Also got a Silver Club donation from Kyle in Portland, Oregon.
Been listening for 2 years. Enjoyed Chaser from Korean Auteurs. Looking forward to the Ray Marathon. Oh, we got to talk about that.
Yes, we do.
Enclosed is a $70 donation. While this may be an unusual amount, it has special significance. August 14 marked my dad's 70th birthday. Movies are something we have shared since I can remember. As a boy, we would laugh till it hurt watching Animal House and the Ernest films, a poor decision on his part in retrospect. In my middle school years, he introduced me to the Oscar greats, such as The Godfather and Chariots of Fire. By high school, the roles had reversed, as I had opened his eyes to great foreign cinema, such as Life is Beautiful and Waltz with Bashir. Even though I only make it home once a year, he always has at least a half dozen movies on the DVR waiting for us to watch. So in honor of my father, Bob Eilenfeld, thank you for all that you do.
Well, thank you, Kyle, for the donation. On behalf of your father, thank you, Bob, for engaging in that great activity of watching movies with your kid. It's wonderful.
And we forgive you for the earnest recommendations.
We do.
Slash exposure.
I forgive Kyle for Life is Beautiful. Waltz with Bashir.
I was wondering if you were going to say anything about that.
I couldn't resist. I mean, he sends money our way, and I have to trash one of his picks. A Buck a Show donation. Jeffrey in Loganville, PA. He left us a really nice voicemail thanking us for the inspiration. He started his own podcast last year, a sailing show called Shooting the Breeze Sailing. And just a short time ago, Josh, he released his first episode of a music podcast called Hootenanny Down the Hall. The first episode features a UK singer-songwriter named David Ford, who Jeffrey is the one who sent David Ford our way. We featured him a couple times on the show. I do like his work. So congratulations, Jeffrey. Thanks for the donation. And we'll link to more information about his podcast in our show notes.
See, that's what we need more of. There are plenty of film podcasts
right,
out there.
Sailing,
how about
though?
Some more Sailing and Hootenanny? Now, if you combine the two, Jeffrey,
you got something.
You will own that demographic.
You'll own iTunes, I think, actually. Final donation and our final note to us comes from Jesse Aloof in New York, New York.
Hey guys, I emailed you back in January promising to donate. I finally have, and it was long overdue. When I first downloaded your podcast back in 2009, I thought you were cinema snobs. I wasn't here yet. That's why. Looking back over the last 5 years, it is easy to see that the problem lied with me and not you. My taste in cinema was so juvenile and simplistic, I never cared to search for movies that peeled back more than one layer of truth about life and meaning, nor cared to envelop myself in the canon of a director's filmography. I still love my sci-fi and comic films, but now I can more appreciate a foreign film like Once Upon a Time in Anatolia or A Separation, or small films that hit deeply like Short Term 12. These films are far superior in many respects to an abundance of what Hollywood produces in a 12-month cycle, and I owe that to you for guiding me in that direction. Cheers to you for exposing people to different and new forms of cinematic expression and for balancing that enlightenment with coverage of some of Hollywood's mainstays.
Well, thank you, Jesse, again, for the donation and the kind words. And of course, we read that because Jesse took the time to write it, and it is a little bit of yay us. But I hope that when you hear someone like Jesse, if you're not convinced by some of these movies like Once Upon a Time in Anatolia or A Separation, or they just seem whatever, a little too daunting to dive into, there's a note from a guy like Jesse who says he used to feel that way. And now, over the years, his tastes have evolved a little bit and he loves movies like that. So hopefully we can continue, Josh, to turn people on to films like those and Short Term 12 and many others. Final thank you to everyone for your long-lasting and just overwhelming support of Film Spotting over the years.
Hey there, Film Spotting listeners. This is Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU. And on our latest episode, we're discussing Southcliffe, the British miniseries from Martha Marcy May Marlene director Sean Durkin.
And inspired by Southcliffe, we're also going to recommend some movies set in small towns. And like all small towns, this podcast will look and sound charming and quaint, but it will actually hide a dark secret.
Good evil laugh.
Yeah, thank you. To find out what it is, subscribe to the show on iTunes or listen at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting. And you're listening to Film Spotting.
I have good news for you. I am going to be a father. You hear that, boy? Yeah. He aimed straight and true. I feel like William Tell now. I don't know who the mother is, but hey.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're paying tribute this week to the late Robin Williams with our top five Robin Williams scenes. We've already shared our five and four picks. It's time now for the top three. And we are not confining ourselves, Josh, solely to his feature film performances. You just heard a clip there from 1982's An Evening with Robin Williams Live in San Francisco. I remember seeing that at the time it came out,
really?
Roughly that age, probably 8 or 9, and just thinking it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen, at least until I watched Eddie Murphy Delirious.
Yeah, my 5 and 4 did come from feature films, actually. It was the technical difficulties sequence in Good Morning Vietnam and then his talk show appearance in World's Greatest Dad. But for my number 3, I am going to An Evening with Robin Williams. I watched a lot of his stand-up over the last week because I hadn't had that experience when it first came out. I do remember seeing him on The Tonight Show as a kid, but his stand-up I just took a look at, and I found this really revelatory moment in this 1982 HBO special, which was taped at San Francisco's Great American Music Hall. It does mostly consist of his rapid-fire stream-of-consciousness characters, his impressions, his improvisations, but near the end, it pauses for this quiet bit after he announces that he's going to have a baby soon. He launches into this routine pretty much right afterwards, in which he plays both himself as this domineering dad who's trying to direct this kid into comedy, and then he also plays the kid, his own child, who wants nothing to do with show business. So there's this tension going back and forth as he adopts one character and then the other. And he actually follows the kid through life. So he plays the child as a baby.
Oh, yeah.
Then a teenager.
I remember.
And then an independent adult. And the weird thing is, he, as Robin Williams, ages too as this goes on. So at the end, his version of himself is this lonely old drunk who's alienated this kid.
Remember me, ninny ninny. I'm so hard. Pardon me, can you spare $40,000 a week?
out. I don't care what you say. I'm going to find out where that asshole Nielsen lives. The little guy with the box who likes the shows. Damn it, I don't care. I clawed my way to the middle, and I f***ed my way down. I don't care, damn it, I don't care. Right now I'm feeling single and drinking doubles. Ah, Jesus.
It is funny, but it's also sort of weird and sad, really, until Williams once more adopts the guise of that now-grown kid, and he just says, Pop, I've come to take you home.
Christopher? Jesus, you don't want to take me home. You don't want me.
Yeah, I do, Pop. Let's go. Hey, Dad.
And it's like the audience doesn't quite know what to do with it either. Really jarring, because this is a routine that's otherwise, I mean, he spends a lot of time in this talking about his penis, known as Mr. Happy.
Right.
That, you know, that's the majority of the act. And then you get this dropped in the middle of it. So, you know, maybe it suggests that the sentimentality that Williams would go on to embrace in his movie career, and sometimes that was for the good, often it was for the bad. Maybe it wasn't forced upon him, which was always my impression watching some of those mid-period films that weren't that great. Maybe it did come from within a little bit. Mm-hmm. So really fascinating performance in Evening with Robin Williams. And the whole thing is available on YouTube. Vulture actually had a nice roundup of his stand-up stuff that you can find on YouTube. So worth checking that out.
Well, a word I don't think we've uttered yet, but it's certainly going to come up in a moment, if not multiple times. The word vulnerability. And there's really nothing more vulnerable than a stand-up.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
A guy on a stage revealing himself.
That's why
just him in a microphone.
Me.
And so I think it is perfectly appropriate that you went down that path with Robin Williams. Before I get into my top three, one thing I did want to reflect on real quick, Josh, because it was something that really took me back when I heard it. I was listening to Chris Connolly talking to Bill Simmons on his podcast, and he said a line that it just really has stuck with me. And I think it's so appropriate to Robin Williams, because as we touched on earlier in the show, this sense almost of animosity about some of the choices he made.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact in this specific context, they were talking about his most recent TV show, which wasn't on the air very long. And there was just a lot of hatred thrown its way and thrown the way of Robin Williams. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, how ridiculous of a thing it is to get up in front of people and try to make them laugh. And then how ridiculous is it how much we hate them for it when we don't?
So why is that?
I don't know.
I mean, in the
but
case,
it's true, isn't it?
It is true. And in the case of Williams, maybe you wonder that it's the fact that you know how good he can be. And there's something that angers you when you see that he's not either able to do it, or and then you project, well, maybe he's not willing, maybe he's not trying, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. I mean, we've seen early on how good he can be. You just don't want to see him in something that's bad.
That's the less cynical response to that. The more cynical one is Connolly's explanation, which is that we don't like to see our stars age because it reminds us of our immortality.
Yeah.
And unfortunately,
has a lot to do with it too.
I think that's probably true. But another thing he expresses, and I know other people have said this over the past week or so of tributes, our producer, Sam Van Halgren, mentioned this to me over email as well. How is it possible that one of the funniest people in the world, one of the funniest people arguably of all time, was never in a great all-time comedy? Think of a guy like Bill Murray, right? In the 80s, Stripes, Caddyshack, Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
You can point to these movies that everybody immediately goes to. Yep, they're in the top five, top 10, all-time funniest. Robin Williams, always regarded as brilliantly, hilariously funny, yet he just never seemed to go down that path. He was never in a movie like that that had that much success in terms of a comedy.
Well, and the reality of that for me is that I never thought of him when people would say, who's the funniest actor? You know, who do you think is the funniest actor of all time? And Bill Murray is up there for me, probably because he was in some of those movies. And you're right, Williams didn't. Now, he took a fairly committed turn towards drama that maybe reduces. I mean, I think his drama as he pursued that became stronger, maybe we can say, than the comedies he went on to make after his heyday.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a part of it.
Well, I do think that the Murray comparison does provide an interesting counterpoint to Williams, because if you look back at their careers, they were born less than a year apart, both born right here in Chicago. They both made their marks on TV before movies. Murray was a few years before Robin Williams in terms of getting on television. And both have the reputation of being these wild cards, being these improvisers, people who you expect to put on a show for you. Mm-hmm. Even if you just ran into them at dinner, you would sort of expect them to, okay, now act
this
for me.
This is how they always
are. Yeah, that's how they always are. These zany personalities, they're there to entertain. And you never knew just how serious you were supposed to take them because there's this sense that they're always playing a role. The thing with Bill Murray is, and I don't mean this as a knock on him, Bill Murray's role is being Bill Murray. It always has been. I think, compared to Robin Williams, Williams is a character who, much more so than Murray anyway, is always inhabiting someone else. And Sam mentioned this in email. He wondered why someone like a Wes Anderson, how tragic is it that someone like a Wes Anderson, who gave Extra Life, gave this new life to Bill Murray later in his career, it's tragic that some director didn't come along, maybe even like a P.T. Anderson or someone who could really embrace all of his talents and the depth of Robin Williams and give him those kind of opportunities. But I don't know. I think a guy like Bill Murray is actually more malleable to a vision of a certain director because he's very similar performance to performance. He's often aloof and distant, and he kind of allows us to assign a psychology to him. Bill Murray can kind of be whoever we want. It's not a knock on him. They're just very different performers.
Right.
Williams is more specific. He's always shifting. Both are in their own way clowns, but I think it's up to the movie itself or the director to bring the pain to a Bill Murray performance. And I think with Robin Williams, that pain is just always there, even in his really funny roles.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see Bill Murray that way, but you have me thinking about Robin Williams in a Wes Anderson picture now, and maybe there's something too loud about him.
Maybe.
About his style, although we've talked about and probably will talk about a little bit more how he could give some good quiet performances too, but I don't see that match. So.
Well, that's a nice segue, Josh, actually, because I think this performance and this character I'm about to name as my number three seems right out of a movie like Magnolia, and yes, it is a movie where Mr. Happy makes an appearance. It's The Fisher King, and the scene is where he's talking to Amanda Plummer after their date, and he tells her that he thinks she's the greatest thing since spice racks. And it's kind of an unplanned thing here, but there is a nice progression as I look at my list. My number five was that zany, wacky Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam, that first whole sequence where he gets on the radio for the first time. Number four was that subdued Robin Williams from Good Will Hunting. And this scene, I think, is the perfect combination of both. Williams here plays Perry, who obviously mentally disturbed. He's got some schizophrenia. He's clearly showing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And he's confessing to this woman he's been, in a way, stalking, this woman he is head over heels in love with. He confesses to her the depths of his love.
I love you. And I think you're the greatest thing since spice racks. And I've been knocked out several times. If I could just have that first kiss, and I won't be distant. I'll come back in the morning and I'll call you if you let me. But I still don't drink coffee.
It's a very quiet scene. It's subtle. But there is, unlike the Good Will Hunting scene, Josh, there is that motor, I think, that's quietly revving underneath. And you just know that he could step on the gas at any moment if he needs to. And he does that at various points throughout this movie. In this scene, he's not in control like he is with Will Hunting on the park bench. He's opening himself up in such a vulnerable, raw way, and he's in such a precarious position. There's just this sense that at any moment he could say just the wrong thing that might cause him to fall through the ice and tear this whole thing down. It's just such a heartbreaking scene. I've watched it about three times in prepping for this list, and that moment when he says, "I won't be distant, and I'll come back in the morning, and I'll call you if you let me," there's this combination of laughter, maybe at the thought of him being so bold as to presume that they may actually spend a night together. But there's this tinge of real sadness. There's a little bit of a cry. Almost he could burst into tears at any moment. And I don't know if it's at the thought of this character getting to possibly do that. This realization that this dream may happen is almost too overwhelming for him. The way he hits multiple notes in that scene and in just that one line of dialogue is really remarkable. And Terry Gilliam, who directed the film, said that he thinks the Fisher King is in many ways the closest character to Robin. Just that range, he said, the madness, the damage, the pain, the sweetness, the outrageousness. That was the role, I think, that stretched him to the limits. And I think it's tough to argue with Terry Gilliam on that one.
You know, that's also one of those scenes that it takes a lot of bravery for an actor to take on. It's the romantic pledge scene,
yeah.
Right? It's iconic in movies, the ones that really stand out. So to see him take that on and pull it off is really something. Let's stick with the Fisher King, actually, for my number two. It's a movie, when we did our top five films of 1991, I named it as my number one picture, just a really beloved film by me. And there's a double date sequence in this that I love. It's where Jeff Bridges, who plays the DJ that's befriended Perry, and his girlfriend, played by Mercedes Rule, they've arranged this double date with Perry and the Amanda Plummer
character. Yeah, this is right before, I think, the sequence I
was
just talking about.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's the same night. He's wearing the same outfit, the same suit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. So at this dinner, I mean, Plummer is a bit of an odd duck herself. And during the dinner, she's extremely clumsy. She proves to have astonishingly bad table manners. Yet every time she makes a blunder, Perry immediately copies her gaffe so that he deflects the disdainful attention away from her and brings it on him. And it's extremely sweet, actually, and also shows off William's gift for physical comedy, which he has mostly displayed, I'd say, probably in his stand-up and a lot of his impressions. But we think of him more as a motor mouth first, at least I do, than a physical comic. And here we get to see some of this pantomiming and pratfalling, really. And I also like how it depends on William's playing off of another actor. As I talked about in our Dead Poets Society review, his comedy could be exceedingly egocentric, partly because people had to keep up with him. I mean, he was his own thing at his own speed. But here he's responding to someone else's comedy, and it works really well.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't really thought of, how in that scene, as I think back on it, he really is just responding to her, and there's a sense of
improvisationally
delight.
Improvisationally, too. I mean, he has some freedom.
It's great, because as I go through my list, I realize that all of my choices, and this really isn't a shock, all of my choices are Robin Williams scenes where he's not always motor-mouthing, but he is completely dominating the dialogue. Most of the other characters in the scene don't even get a word in. And I just think that speaks to a particular skill that he had and how he was showcased in films, obviously, and obviously maybe something I respond to in him as well. So I'm glad that you found some variety there with that choice from The Fisher King. For my number two, if you believe Terry Gilliam, The Fisher King maybe was the closest character he played to who he really was. But I think that his role as John Keating in Dead Poets Society was maybe the character he was most born to play. If you combine Adrian Cronauer's sense of humor and energy with Sean Maguire's compassion and Perry's idealism in The Fisher King, you get John Keating. There's two parts to the scene that I'm choosing here for number two. It's a long sequence, about 5 minutes. The first part is the understanding poetry section, that first classroom scene in Dead Poets Society. It ends with him prompting the students, challenging them, asking them, what will their verse be? And one of the things that really struck me this time, Josh, as I watched Dead Poets Society, is that I think most of us would actually agree with J. Evans Pritchard, PhD, his fundamental goal in terms of the way he tries to assess poetry. He says he considers how artfully the object of the poem has been rendered, and two, how important is that objective? And I think actually, that's what most of us do. I think most film critics, even if you really break it down, you consider the artfulness of a work and how important the work is.
But do we put it on a chart?
Exactly. That's the problem. That's part of the problem, is putting it on a chart. His failing is that he thinks both the artfulness and the importance are things that can actually be measured objectively, that somehow greatness in art can be determined unequivocally as long as you see the work the way he does. There's no shades of gray. There's no subjectivity. There's no idiosyncratic personal responses. In his world, Byron can't write a sonnet as good as Shakespeare. End of story. The second part of the scene, as I mentioned, is the challenge to the class, where he explains why we read and write poetry. And he says, because we are members of the human race, and the human race is filled with passion. And that each member of his class has an obligation to be part of the human race, not just by existing, by accepting their fates, accepting their identities, but by contributing a verse, asserting themselves on the world. And this scene is one of those obvious Robin Williams scenes to go to for many reasons. It's him being a comedian at many points, him being very funny, putting on all the voices we've come to expect. He gets John Wayne in there, among others. But the content of the scene is really why this is my number two scene. All of the things we just described in terms of how to approach art and how to really approach life, that was revelatory to me in 1989. And beyond that, Josh, of all the words we've used to describe Williams as an actor so far on our list, passion and passionate would be the one word I'd probably settle on if I had to. If I had to just pick one word to describe him, I'd think of passion. And this movie and that scene specifically is all about passion. It informs every moment of his performance as John Keating.
Now, my class, you will learn to think for yourselves again. You will learn to savor words and language. No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world. Now, see that look in Mr. Pitt's eye? Like 19th century literature has nothing to do with going to business school or medical school, right? Maybe. Mr. Hopkins, you may agree with him, thinking, yes, we should simply study our Mr. Pritchard and learn our rhyme and meter and go quietly about the business of achieving other ambitions. I have a little secret for you. Huddle up. Huddle up! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for.
Well, I'm going to stick with Dead Poets Society for my number one, and I'm going to go with another classroom scene, actually. It's the one where Williams gets Ethan Hawke's shy student up in the front of class and pulls an impromptu poem out of him. I love that this moment is played as improv. He tells Hawke early on, don't think, which is an echo of something that he actually says at the start of An Evening with Robin Williams, the stand-up documentary. He says, let's improvise before he kicks off. There's another instruction that he gives to Hawke that could really stand as an epitaph for Williams' own career. Say the first thing that pops into your head, even if it's total gibberish. And then the scene goes on to let that play out. It really is probably the moment for me in Dead Poets when we get that pure Williams craziness from his stand-up days in the right form for this story. I mean, he starts talking faster as he needles Hawke to describe this picture of Walt Whitman that's at the front of class. And that, of course, elicits the beautifully evocative sweaty tooth madman phrase and then the poem that follows.
Good God, boy, there's a poet in you after all.
There, close your eyes.
Close your eyes.
Close them.
Now. Describe what you see.
I close my eyes.
Yes.
And this image floats beside me.
The sweaty tooth madman.
The sweaty tooth madman with a stare that pounds my brain.
Oh, that's excellent. Now give him action. Make him do something.
His hands reach out and choke me.
That's wonderful, wonderful.
And all the time he's mumbling.
What's he mumbling?
Mumbling truth. Yeah, yeah. Truth like a blanket that always leaves your feet cold.
Forget them, forget them. Stay with the blanket. Tell me about that blanket.
You push it, stretch it, it'll never be enough. You kick at it, beat it, it'll never cover any of us. From the moment we enter crying to the moment we leave dying, it'll just cover your face as you wail and cry and scream.
Don't you forget this.
This also goes back to the idea of generosity that I've been talking about, the moment with Plummer in The Fisher King. And Williams understands here, you get the sense, that this is really Hawke's scene. And he seems to even be delighting in helping Hawke to be so good in it. That's his role in this scene, both as an actor and as the character. And he even expresses this physically once Hawke starts launching into that poem and he's kind of pushed him out of the nest in a way. Williams, as Keating, backs away from Hawke.
Yeah, he kind of crouches down.
He crouches down at the front of class and gives Hawke the stage. So it does become that other character's moment, but for me, it's still my number one Robin Williams scene.
Yeah, that scene is one, honestly, I'd completely forgotten about. Like, it's not one of those scenes that I think of immediately when I think about Dead Poets Society, and yet it was one of my favorite scenes on this rewatch. My number one is a scene from a movie that has certainly been talked about a little bit, not a ton, over the past 9.5 years, but it's come up always in the context of movies that are just personal favorites of mine that no one seems to love as much as I do. And there was a point maybe 5 or 6 years ago where I think I even did have to put it in the penalty box and it couldn't come up on a top five list for a little while. But the movie is one of Robin Williams' early performances in The World According to Garp, directed by George Roy Hill, adapted from the John Irving novel. And the scene is The Magic Gloves. Now, as I've always said with this movie, Garp, it's a film I watched at way too young of an age, probably about 8 years old. There was a lot I didn't get about it, a lot of mysteries I had to try to sort out. And in some ways, it's a movie that still haunts me today, but I'm so grateful I saw it at that young age. And it is another scene with Williams playing a character like his character in Dead Poets Society, who is explaining language to us. He's not explaining a poem, but actually a short story he's written to his mother, Jenny Fields, played by Glenn Close.
I'm not sure I understand it.
Mom, it's very simple. He can do wonders when he's wearing his magic gloves. If his wife is sad, he just touches her with his gloves and she's happy. If his children are crying, he just touches them and they smile. But he can't feel them. He yearns to feel. He can even hold off death with his magic gloves, but he can't feel life. So he takes off the gloves and he dies, but he finally feels life as he's flying into the arms of death.
I like that. If that's what it means, I like it.
And as I look back on it, Josh, I don't think there's honestly anything really remarkable about what Williams is doing in terms of his performance, but it is about, for me, the scene. It has a lot of personal resonance for me, just as the Dead Poets Society scene does, because I do have to believe it informs what we're doing here right now. The scene starts with him seeing this little domestic drama play out, this quick spat with a husband and wife who get out of a taxi cab in front of him. The husband drops his gloves, and those gloves inspire him to write a story. And we see him taking something from real life and transforming it into art. He types on the typewriter, and the story that he's writing is being portrayed on screen for us. So it's kind of what's going on in his head. He not only draws from what happened that day, just a short time ago, but from his far past. At one point, the husband in his story is sitting out on a ledge. He's playing a piano, and it looks like he could fall from the sky to his death. And a character who tried to save Garp when he was a kid playing on the roof earlier in the movie becomes part of the scene. He actually says exactly what he said back when Garp was a kid. So he's integrating that into the story. And then at the end, this is something I never noticed, Josh, honestly, until today, and I've seen Garp probably 15 times. We discover that there's a saxophonist in an apartment across the street playing the song that the man in the story is playing on the piano. Mm. Nat King Cole's There Will Never Be Another You. So he's drawing from his very recent past, his very long ago past, and actually what's happening in the moment he's creating. He takes that saxophone tune and works it into the story. The second part of the scene, and the part I really love, is when his mother reads it and she doesn't get it. And he has to explain to her what the story means. And maybe it says something about Garp's abilities as a writer, that she only approves of it and gets it after he does lay it all out for her and says it's so simple. Or maybe it's just that she's that obtuse as a character. Either way, I remember just being awed watching Williams elucidate for his mother in this scene the power of art. Reveal the way a story or a poem or a painting or whatever it is can say something profound. It can be saying something and transcend just the words on the page. And there's the line in the story where he talks about the character yearning to feel. With Williams, I feel like, I said that pain is always there in his performances. What I really feel like is he was always yearning to know, to learn, to understand. I think that's what really drives his characters, because they never had any trouble just feeling. That was just a rawness that he brought to any character he played. But the man in the story may actually be, Josh, a stand-in in some ways for Williams himself, and that he describes the character as a guy who, as long as he's wearing his gloves, he could fix anything that's wrong with his family, but he couldn't really feel them. So he's a guy who brings so much joy to others while himself was clearly feeling so much pain. And as we see what happened to Robin Williams and hear more about his life and some of the demons he wrestled with, that seems appropriate. That seems, unfortunately, like something that was probably a reality. A guy who just, anyone who was around him or took in some of these great performances on screen, we felt that joy. And you hope he felt some part of that joy and feel like he probably didn't have enough of it in his life.
Well, you're right about this current in his characters, where they did seem to be searching after something, taking mm-hmm. them all in at the same time and looking at them throughout his career, really. That was an aspect of a lot of his characters. You know, I knew The World According to Garp was going to be on your list, so I didn't bump it up in my viewing priorities as much because of that. But also, I'm afraid to watch this one, because what if I don't like it?
Yeah.
I feel like I don't want to just crush you that way, Adam.
Just don't post it on Letterboxd and just don't tell me.
Keep it to myself.
Just keep it to yourself.
All right.
Don't post it on Twitter. Post it on your website. I don't visit your website.
Oh, well, there we go.
No, that would hurt. That would hurt, Josh. But it's a movie I do encourage everybody to go see. In fact, I was thinking about this with this list, that first week I went to college, the uh-huh. movie that I met all my new friends on my floor freshman year, what movie did I say to all of them? You got to watch this movie. let's sit down and watch this, our first movie night. I made everybody watch The World According to Her.
How'd that go over? Did you still have any friends?
No, they didn't really talk about
it
much.
Did you find new friends?
I doubt they have any recollection of watching it. I don't think it had any impact on them whatsoever, but it nailed me when I was, again, 8 or 9 years old, and it's just stuck with me ever since. I haven't seen it in its entirety probably since my freshman year of school.
Oh, wow.
It's one I just do really love. Hopefully there are some other World According to Garp fans out there. I know we should probably get into some honorable mentions. If we went down this path, we'd be here for another 20 or 30 minutes talking about all the great scenes. I considered multiple scenes from all the movies I've mentioned, and a bunch I didn't, like World's Greatest Dad. Even One Hour Photo, a movie I don't love, but a movie I like, has some great Robin Williams moments in it. So we could talk all day. Are there any, though, that you really feel like you got to single out?
Well, I think we're going to get in trouble for not having Aladdin.
Yeah.
On either of our lists.
I thought it would make your list,
Josh. That's sort of a long conversation we maybe don't have time for, because I really go back and forth on that film. I like it for sure, but specifically regarding his performance. I can't decide whether he's, you know, elevating this otherwise routine Disney musical, or if he's intruding on something that could have been maybe more magical with another tone.
Really?
I don't know.
I mean, I've only seen it once, but is that possible it could be better without that performance?
Well, it's just, it would be so different, and he's very jarring, but he's good. So as you can tell, it's complicated. There is my favorite moment, though, is when he's asked what he would wish for. I think that does combine that sort of quietness that does come in some of his best moments with a good joke that he gets into. So there's that. And also want to throw out quickly, season 6, it is, I believe, of Louis, from Louis C.K.
Yeah, I just watched that.
Yeah, I think that's worth checking out. I mean, it's very wistful and sad in light of his death, of course, in what happens in the scene. But it's really a different aspect of him, I felt, even different than some of his serious roles. He's kind of playing a variation on himself there. So
yeah.
Fascinating in that sense.
Yeah, I do like that as well. It's available on Netflix. You can watch it streaming there, Netflix Instant, if you so desire. Those are our top 5 Robin Williams scenes. Please do send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting. We're also on Facebook, of course. That's at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Opening this weekend in limited release in Chicago, a couple of the titles that will highlight Mobius. This is the latest film from Korea's Kim Ki-duk, or Kim Ki-do. I don't know if we ever settled on a proper pronunciation, though we did review one of his films.
Three Iron,
we discussed,
right?
Yeah, Three Iron, which I really liked, I recall.
Was that your favorite?
That was my favorite
series?
Film of the marathon that we did on Korean auteurs last year. It's been described as an Oedipal tragedy, which actually seems like a movie Robin Williams would really love. Oedipus was kind of a go-to reference for him. The One I Love is out. Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss retreat to the country in an attempt to save their marriage. This is a comedy, but also a little bit of a mind-bender from what I've heard. And it's also a little bit divisive. I've seen reactions all over the board on Twitter to The One I Love, but it's my guy, Mark Duplass, so I'm definitely curious about it. The movie I really can't wait to see, one of my most anticipated movies of the year, The Trip to Italy, is out. Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon, they pack their bags and their Michael Caine impressions. And that's really all I need for more conversations about food, death, show business, you name it.
And if you're like me and somehow have not seen The Trip, that also is streaming on Netflix right now.
Okay.
So I'm going to
try
to
catch up with it before
Definitely.
Trip to Italy?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, good stuff. Finally, out in wide release, a few different titles, but the one we'll highlight, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. This is the follow-up to 2005 Sin City from Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller. Next week, we're planning to discuss Sin City 2. Also, Frank, starring Michael Fassbender, Donald Gleason, and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and inspired by Frank. We're going to share, are you on board with this, Josh, our top 5 movie bands?
I'm just trying to catch up still, so yeah, sure.
You're just going to follow along with whatever we say at
exactly.
this point. Okay, I like it. We'll go with that.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to Associate Producer Candace Griffiths and to the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Catchy as Larson recommends.
Not until you have theme music. You have to wait until you have
theme music. Maybe we bring back the theme music for Adam's articulate analysis.
I'd like to hear
it was
that.
The, it was the response to Maddie's Movie Minute.
So how many, they they how both many had buried theme songs
They both
there?
Had theme songs. A guy wrote in. It's actually really fun. It's just like 15 seconds. Maddie's Movie Minute. It's great. And then, so then I had to, I joked
Sounds
around
like
that
a kid show.
I had to come up with a response. It's called Adam's Articulate Analysis. And he came up with a theme song for it. It's funny.
Wow.
It's really good. Okay.
How far away are we from putting out an album?
Too far. All right, let's do this.